Welcome to the Film Experience Podcast. This is your co-host, Murtada, and I am here with Nathaniel. How are you this morning, Nathaniel?
I'm great.
And we are here today for a special edition of our podcast where we'll be talking 100% reader questions. And we got so many reader questions. We were so happy.
Thank you for everybody.
Yeah. Thank you for everybody who sent us questions.
It was a little overwhelming. I had to turn the comments off at one point.
Oh, you did that?
Yeah. Because I was like, this is more than we can answer in an hour. So, but that's a good problem to have. So thank you, everyone.
Yes. Thank you so much. Then I think we should start with this one because it's one that I don't think I have the answer for, but maybe Nathaniel, you can help us here. So Bruno says, who will win SAG for Best Supporting Actress? Since Regina King has won, of course, the Golden Globes and the BFCA, but she's not nominated. Do you have a guess?
Originally I was like, oh, it'll be Amy Adams for sure. But then I thought to myself, would it, though? Because Vice is not really that popular. It's done okay, but it, you know, at the box office or whatever. But if we talk about SAG as a more populist voting body,
mm-hmm.
are they going to really think about, oh, Amy doesn't have her Oscar yet? Like, I personally don't feel Amy Adams' campaign has really been forceful this year as it has been in other years.
Yes, but yes, especially when you compare it to the Year of Arrival, yes.
Right, so it's possible that it could go to one of the favorite ladies. I don't think Emily Blunt can win. I just don't think that would happen.
Mm-hmm.
I think Amy Adams is probably the safe bet, but I by no means think she's locked up, so it is interesting.
I mean, I don't know who's going to win, but I have a favorite scenario.
Okay. You
know? To get Regina King her Oscar, she won two televised awards so far, and there's two coming where she's not nominated. So I would like to have two different winners, so by the time we get to the Oscars, she would have won the most. Because if we get one winner for SAG and BAFTA, that will be tough competition for her. She will have like a particular person she's competing against. But if we say Emily Blunt wins SAG and Rachel Weisz wins BAFTA, or in any combination of the nominees, these are just two examples I'm putting out there. As long as it's not the same, I'll be happy.
Yeah. I mean, I think if Amy wins both, that's potential trouble. Because then the campaign can kick into high gear of she's never won.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
And you know, people are like, oh, I didn't want her to win for this. Listen, people win for their mediocre performances all the time versus their best performances.
Yeah.
So we might have to face up to it.
Yeah, and you know what?
Who knows, like, maybe Regina King will win for a mediocre performance in the future instead of this great one.
Yeah, absolutely. And, like, Amy Adams has given so many great performances. Like, if she wins, that's fine. Like, she's not my choice this year, but, you know, like you said.
She has been worthy before, so there's at least that.
Absolutely, yes. She is somebody who should have an Oscar on her mantle, so
right.
If it's this year, then that's fine.
Right. Now, we got a lot of questions about category fraud, and I want to get this out of the way really quick because I know everybody's sick of us talking about it. Peggy, Sue, and Ben1283 both asked, you know, if the Academy put their foot down, how do you solve a problem like category fraud? This is a general type of question. And, I don't want to dwell too much. I think the easiest way to do it is to make a rule that if you're one of the top two billed people in a movie, that you are automatically disqualified from supporting, but they could also petition the way mm-hmm. the Tony Awards can. You know, I've heard people saying you can't do what the Tony Awards do because there's 300 movies a year, you know, something like that are eligible every year. And, you know, the Tonys only have like 40 productions or whatever. But mm-hmm. you can do it, because the Tonys have a very hard and fast rule. If your name is above the title, you are a lead.
Mm-hmm.
And you can petition if you feel that's not appropriate. And every once in a while, there are exceptions, which there would be here, too. But you wouldn't have situations like Thelma and Louise, one of them is supporting. Or Carol, mm-hmm. one of them is supporting, because the top two build people are the leads.
Mm-hmm.
You would still have some issues, like the favorite.
Yeah, that sounds like a good solution to it. But my opinion on that is that that ship has sailed and we'll just have to deal with it every year. It's like they found a way to game the system and everybody's happy.
Ay, ay, ay. The follow-up question to Ben's thing about category fraud is what supporting performance would have gained traction if you didn't have Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz in there? Which is a good question. It's also a hard question because there's been so little conversation.
Yes.
My go-to answer always is Elizabeth Debicki, but, you know, for whatever reason, people didn't respond to Widows. So I'm guessing it would probably be more someone like Michelle Yeoh for Crazy Rich Asians.
And I mean, you know, now that I'm looking forward to, like, maybe people talking about the actual performances, because, you know, no matter what you think of what category they're in, like, Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz gave amazing performances in The Favourite. So hopefully once they are nominated and we can't change anything about which category they've been nominated for, we can talk about how good they are or what we loved about their performances, you know, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
Yeah, Jakey has a very, very good question. I love this question. What is your favorite original screenplay nomination ever?
Ever? That's such a hard question.
I only went back and looked at, like, the last couple of decades. What was one of yours, Nathaniel?
Scrolling.
While you're scrolling, I'll just say, like, there is one from last year that I really, really loved, and it was, when it was announced, it was like, you know, I whooped with joy. It was The Big Sick, because the narrative there of, you know, Kumail and Emily Gordon, their story together, this was their story, they wrote it together, and then to get nominated together, that was, like, cute story. The movie was good, they were such a... you know, they were so nice to see them together on the campaign trail and at events and stuff. It was one of the joys of the season. So for that reason, I would choose The Big Sick. I would choose The Separation, because that was, like, probably one of the best screenplays ever written. And one of those nominations where you're like, wow, they actually, the writers actually, you know, looked at the screenplays that year, because very rare do foreign language films get in there.
Yeah, that's a great answer, A Separation. I tend to think original screenplay is one of the best categories, period, from year to year.
Yeah.
It's often where you'll have more idiosyncratic movies or more movies that feel like unique visions. For that reason, one of my all-time favorite screenplay nominees is Boogie Nights, which I think is so brilliant, and it heralded such an important, you know, cinematic talent to come. And the other thing I just want to give a shout out to, because I think it's so weird, but I enjoy it, is all of the Mike Leigh nominations in this category.
Oh, they love him in this category, yeah.
But the hilarious thing about that is he famously doesn't really write the screenplays until after all the rehearsals, and so he's using all the improv or whatever to fashion the screenplays.
Yeah.
And yet, he's the only one who gets credit, but it's very, very collaborative screenwriting, essentially. So it's a very cool thing about this category, I think.
One last cool thing I'll mention about Best Original Screenplay is, like, Pedro Almodovar won this category for Talk to Her. That was also one, I think, it's just, you know, another foreign language film. You don't expect, you know, those two, they don't win that much outside of foreign language category, so... That's also a surprise. And that was a good year. There were other nominees that could have won, but, you know, I'm glad Pedro won. It's a good screenplay. Mm-hmm. He has, like, an individual Oscar. You know, everybody's happy.
Yeah. Okay, here's a totally left-field question. Jonathan asks, do we still buy DVDs and Blu-rays? I feel like I must be the only one, and everyone gives me a hard time about it. So do you buy Blu-rays or DVDs?
No. I mean, you know, I don't have space to store them.
Yes, we live in New York.
Yes. So I think the last DVD I bought was In the Mood for Love, and that's probably more than a decade ago.
Mm-hmm. I still buy them, but for very specific purposes. See, the reason I don't buy more of them is I get a lot of DVDs from the studios. This year was an exception because of I moved and such, but I usually have way too many more than I can deal with from all the screeners. So I don't really buy them, but I do buy regularly for the Supporting Actress SmackDown, which is returning soon. So the last DVD I bought was Pete and Tilly with Carol Burnett, since Geraldine Page got a nomination for that.
Oh, wow.
And
what year was this?
This was 1972, which we'll be doing in the end of March or beginning of April. Dates to be announced soon.
Oh, that's cool.
We have to wait until Oscar season passes, but then we'll definitely be back to it. And then before that, the last one I bought was So Proudly We Hail, which was the 43 SmackDown. So now whenever I want to watch Paulette Goddard's SmackDown-winning, Oscar-losing performance, it's right there for me.
So you have a very, very specific reason for buying DVDs.
I do. So I have really weird collection.
Yeah.
Really so random collection.
If you buy DVDs for a very specific reason like that, let us know in the comments. We would love to hear from you.
Oh, and also, I think Nick would want to say he could not be here for this podcast, but I think he would want to encourage Jonathan and anyone else who buys DVDs. Nick has an amazing collection and totally believes in physical copies of things. And there's been so many times I thought, oh, how will I find that? And Nick actually owns it. So there's a reason to have physical copies.
Yes. Are you ready for the next question?
Yep.
So Andy says, out of all the movies you've seen this year, which character's wardrobe would you most want to wear in real life? His answer is that he wants Ryan Gosling's yellow mock turtleneck from First Man.
Which is, yes. Can we touch you if you wear it? Can we stroke your arm gently?
Yeah. I have to say, I really coveted all of Rachel Weisz's riding clothes from The Favourite. You know, those long blazers and pants. She looked so good in that movie whenever she was going riding. But I don't know if I can pull off her walk. Because, you know, she walks with such conviction in those clothes. So I'll have to work on my walk. Once I get that wardrobe from, you know, from Sandy Powell, I hear she's sending it to me.
Mm-hmm. I don't have an answer for this question, which makes me sad. Because usually I do, but I don't. I don't think I can pull off most of the outfits that I loved. Like, one modern man's wardrobe that I loved this year was Lakeith Stanfield's in Sorry to Bother You.
Oh, yeah.
But that's it's very colorful suits, and men of color can pull those off more than pale white guys like me.
He really did look good. Yeah, that's a good one I haven't thought of. So, readers, why don't you answer this question, too, in the comments? Tell us which wardrobe you have coveted.
If the Film Experience had a huge budget and a video podcast show, I'd be tempted to put the whole team in Support the Girls drag.
Wow. I don't know what I think about that. Okay, what's the next question, Nathaniel?
Okay, controversy. Sad Man asks, why do we think there are no female directors that are an actual threat this year for a nomination? And he posits, is it because some of the locked movies, like The Favorite and The Wife and Best Actress, are considered women's strength? Centric, so the feminist quota is already filled.
Oh.
My controversial answer to this question, which is the same reaction I had during that one year of Oscar So White, is the problem is not with the Oscars so much as it's with Hollywood. In what it gets made, who gets hired. So a lot of the female directors who did really good work this year, like Chloe Zhao in The Rider, Mariel Heller in Can You Ever Forgive Me, Lynn Ramsey, You Were Never Really Here, these are not movies that would get male directors nominated either. Like,
yes.
Especially because even the best example might be Deborah Granik in Leave No Trace. That is the type of movie that would regularly, even if it was doing better than it's done, I think that would get, that would be the likely drop from Best Director because it's more actor focused.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes I don't think there is quotas. I'm glad that they have to think about it now because there's been so much press, and I think that's definitely helping with more diverse slates of acting nominees. And I hope that it will make more diverse slates of directors in the future. But this year, I don't really see how that could happen unless Deborah Granik surprises.
Yeah.
Because some of the articles about it, I'm like, okay, you're stretching. Like, Mary Queen of Scots. I'm sorry, that's just not deserving of a Best Director nomination.
Yeah. But it is still disappointing. But what I think is a positive thing, like last year, I think this year we have more women directors in the conversation, even if they are all long shots.
Yes.
And last year we had somebody who was actually nominated because, you know, with Tamara Jenkins, Chloe Zhao, Nadine Labaki, Deborah Granik, Mariel Heller, that's a lot more than last year, which I think was only Greta Gerwig and Dee Reeves. So
yeah,
that's a positive thing.
And very quality movies, but they're also, unfortunately, small movies, which always have a tougher time with Oscar. I think Nadine Labaki's an interesting option. Had the movie opened earlier or been more immediately successful, like I think it's going to do okay in art houses. It's doing okay so far. But I think if she had gotten the kind of press that, like, Paolo Lukowski has gotten for Cold War, for example, you might see someone like that rise up. Like, I would love if we had another female director of a foreign movie, which hasn't happened in a million years.
Yeah, it happened only that time. that one time.
Yeah. So that would be really cool because every year it seems like there's at least one movie that's in the foreign film conversation that's directed by a woman. Sometimes they don't get nominated, but last year we had one female nominee in that category, and this year we hopefully will get one female nominee for Capernaum.
Yeah. And, you know, Alicia Rohrwacher also is Happy as Lazarus. That's another one that people also love. Yeah. But I'd say Labaki's degree of difficulty was, I think, higher than a lot of the directors who are going to get the nomination.
Yeah.
It's just what she had to work with for Capernaum.
But I will say, if she keeps this up, because all three of her movies have been very well received, if she speeds up and keeps this up, I could see her becoming one of those foreign masters where they eventually feel compelled, you know. It took Pedro Almodovar a long time to get that director nomination, et cetera.
Yeah. So anyway, there is positive thing. Yes. That's good.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have an interview with Labaki, so if anybody hasn't read it yet, go and read it. It's really interesting and a good read.
Yeah. And again, I don't want to say that I know my comment about Mary Queen of Scots was a little snarky. A lot of female directors did great work this year. It's just a matter of having more of a balance in who's behind the camera before we can see regularly that will have effect with the Oscars.
Are you ready to move on to the next question? So Cash says, which film or films this year best encapsulate the state of society in 2018? He thinks that last year it was Get Out and Ingrid Go West. So the answer I have for this one is Sorry to Bother You, because I think its message of anti-capitalism is something that really sort of tells of the way that we live today in especially here in America, where we are really governed by greedy corporations and people are getting fucked over in a lot of ways for their labor, and their labor is being stolen from them in a lot of ways because of the way that capitalism has evolved. So that's the movie that comes to my mind when I think of what movie sort of represents 2018. So well done, Boots Riley.
Yeah, I wrote down like six movies to answer this question, but because I don't think anything is as pinpoint as like Cash. Those are great examples. Get Out, Ingrid Goes West. They really do talk about the now. I think Sorry to Bother You is a great example, and I would also suggest The Inverse, which is Crazy Rich Asians, because Crazy Rich Asians is like capitalist fantasy, like aspirational wealth, all that, and Sorry to Bother You is more, it's fantastical, but it's more grounded in the real ways people live and are affected by the pursuit of wealth and how imbalanced
everything is. Yes,
everything is. So yeah, so I think those two are really good answers. I do think, from personal perspective, that's going to sound so despairing. I thought about First Reformed for this answer.
I mean, it's dealing with something, you know, that we should be dealing more seriously with.
Yeah.
And the environment.
Yeah, and the environment, I think the despair around how impotent people feel about how to make any changes, you know, those things I think are... Yeah, there's a lot of good possible answers to this question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Another one would be Black Panther. The buzz phrase, Black Excellence, people have talked about it so long, and there you have a whole movie that's positing and that's theorizing, fantasizing about an entire world of Black Excellence that was hidden from us.
Yeah.
So yeah. I think that's obviously a very zeitgeisty movie this year.
Yeah, but by all means, reward Green Book, Hollywood. Anyway, let's move on. I was trying not to mention that movie, but what's the next question you want to talk about, Nathaniel?
Okay, that's an easy one. Jeff asks, do you think Shallow is strong enough that even if Lady Gaga had won a couple of years ago, she would still win again this year? And I think the answer is yes. Best original song nominees, where the song is A, great, and B, has like a pinpoint best scene in the movie placement, makes you sort of an unquestionable front runner.
Yeah.
Another example I thought of that would be the title's escaping me right now, but Once... that musical about the...
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or they not won a musical, that. But... Yeah, they won. And they had that pinpoint pivotal scene where they write the song together. And it was the best scene in the movie, and it was, like, so artistically compelling, that scene. I think Shallow is kind of, like, the pivot point where the movie sort of explodes. I just think it would win in basically any year.
It's also a big, huge hit. And that, you know... sometimes it doesn't happen so often that you have, although it has happened in the last few years a lot, but it doesn't happen that much when a song has really taken hold of the culture like that.
How about you? Next question.
Yes. Ben Kelly wants to know, what are some of your favorite performances that haven't been getting any notices on the awards circuit? He lists Harry Neff from Assassination Nation and Charlie Plummer from Lean on Pete. So many, like, I think I've talked on this podcast about how much I love Sakura Andu in Shoplifters. And I think I'm giving my best actress winner this year is Carey Mulligan in Wildlife. That's like the performance that just boom, hit me so hard. And I've always loved her, but I think she has went to sort of another level this year in Wildlife, and I'm just excited to see what she's going to do next. What about you?
Those are great choices. I'm giving away a couple of Film Bitch nominations here, which but I don't think this will surprise you. Alessandro Nivola in Disobedience.
Yes.
He won the British Independent Film Award, but that was his only recognition for that movie. And I think he's brilliant in it. And I also think it's an interesting sort of bookend to one of his earlier performances, Junebug, where he plays this sort of religious guy whose partner didn't know he had all this religious background. And so I thought it was like an interesting bookend to another key performance of his. Plus, he's just amazing in it.
I would also mention Zena Rofia from Capernaum, who it's the best child actor performance maybe in the decade. He's so good in that movie. And if it wasn't for Bradley Cooper, I would also give him my best actor win. He's my number two, so I love that performance. There is a question from Chris P, which is sort of like dovetails very well with this question, which is basically he's saying if they saw this movie, then why? Why not both of these actors? So he's like, why do, you know, like sort of, let's say Beale Street, for example, only Regina King is getting nominations, but there are other performances in the movie. I would personally go with both Colman Domingo and Brian Tyree Henry for that movie and supporting actors. So do you have a movie like that, Nathaniel?
I have one specifically this year, other than Elizabeth Debicki, who I've mentioned like a gazillion times this year, for Widows. Like, even when Viola shows up, sometimes they still don't mention Elizabeth. It's like, what?
Yeah.
Like, were people watching a different movie than I was watching? Because that performance blew me away. But I love the question, and Chris P., I love that game. He calls the game, if you saw this, then why? And he mentions Ewan McGregor from Beginners.
Yeah.
Got no attention, and Christopher Plummer won the Oscar. Great example. You'll remember Ewan McGregor was nominated at the Film Bitch Awards. but my favorite all-time example of if you saw this, then why, is Stanley Tucci getting shut out, no attention whatsoever, for Julie and Julia. And the same year getting nominated for what I think is possibly his worst performance in The Lovely Bones.
Yeah.
And they obviously watched Julie and Julia.
They did, I don't know why they could have just... And they wanted to nominate him, so just replace the name of the movie.
Oh, that was just so frustrating. So yeah, Chris P., I like that game. I think we'll keep playing it in the future.
Yeah. I have one. I know, Can You Ever Forgive Me? You know, Richard E. Grant and Melissa McCarthy are getting nominated, but Dolly Wells is so heartbreaking as the woman who has a crush on Lee Israel in the movie and goes on that heartbreaking date with her. It's a supporting performance that's so beautiful. I think she did so well. So that would be another one I was thinking about.
Yeah. I think if she had another scene or if she was more famous, I think she might have gotten attention for that performance.
Yeah.
But at least she's put herself on the map.
Yes, for sure.
The next question. Has there ever been a category? This is from Tom G. Has there ever been a category or year where you would have completely replaced all the nominated films or performances with different ones?
Wow.
This is such a bitchy question, and I love it so much. And for me, that's almost every year in supporting actor and supporting actress. I was looking over the Film Bitch nominations from the past decade, and I actually could not find a year where it was 0-5.
Oh, wow.
But I found 1 out of 5 so many times.
Oh, really?
Usually the Academy doesn't fuck up completely across the board, but a lot of times it's disappointing and supporting. And I think the reason for that is supporting, at least for Academy members, I think because they see less movies than we do, it's so bound up in Best Picture. And I think that's why supporting often has sort of milquetoast type of choices. That and category fraud.
So do you wanna tell us some of your 1 out of 5 correlations?
Viola Davis in The Help was my only Best Actress nominee that I would have kept. from that
list. Oh, from that year, yeah.
2011. Oh. So that was with Best Actress, the only year it was that few. Oh, and 2013, Cate Blanchett, who won, was my only similar choice to the Academy.
Oh. There's usually, like, for me, I hear what you're saying, but there's usually, like, a couple of performances I really love, so I haven't actually looked to see how it measured with my own, because I don't keep, you know, lists like you do, so it would be hard for me to answer this question, but there is always, like, one, at least one or two that are like, oh, yeah, I love those, but usually supporting actor is the worst.
Yeah.
Like, I remember the year of The Hurt Locker when I really loved Anthony Mackie's performance.
Yes.
And anybody who was nominated that year was so much, you know, like Matt Damon in Invictus. And you have already mentioned The Lovely Bones. So, like, those got nominated. Anthony Mackie was in the Best Picture winner, and he still didn't get nominated.
Oh, and we go back to the other questions. If you saw this, then why?
Exactly, yes.
Yeah.
They did see The Hurt Locker.
Yeah, and he was so much better than the nominees that year. Christoph Waltz, who was my only transfer that year from the Oscar list.
I mean, the winners have been good in Best Supporting Actor for the most part, except, you know, for some years. We don't want to mention last year, that wasn't a good year. But the winners have been good, like Christoph Waltz, Javier Bardem. Mm-hmm. There have been some good winners in supporting actor, even though the other nominees are usually like, what the fuck are you? So we're recording this on Sunday, and we have a question, and the nominations are Tuesday morning, so less than 48 hours from when we're recording, and we have a question about the nomination announcements. So Howard's End asks, considering the changes that were made to the nomination announcement, what do you hope to see for this year's announcement? What would be your ideal nomination if you were given creative control? And really my answer to that, no frills. You know that meme of Isabelle Huppert when she goes to the cinema, she's like, no talking, no candy. I was like, nothing. I just want two people standing there reading the names of the nominees with corresponding picture of the film nominated in the background. That is all I need. Just do that. And hopefully that's what they do. I don't need Jason Reitman to tell me what it meant to him to get the phone call that told him he got nominated before he says, and this year's nominees for Best Actor are, so don't do that, please.
Yeah, that whole produced reel, it's like, why? We're just there to learn the names. It's a very important warning.
Yes. So, yeah. And if that person who can read the nominees is Isabelle Huppert, that's also good. Because, you know, she'll just read the names and we will move on. But I am excited this year for Tracy Ellis Ross and Kumail Nanjiani. I think, you know, they are two attractive, charming people who can just read the nominations and go through. I hope they don't do too much banter, because when Emma Stone and Seth MacFarlane did the whole jokes about the nominees, that was terrible. So hopefully they don't do that.
Yeah. On this sort of same front, on, you know, Oscar, the way they do things, Chris asks, I always thought the hosting gig could go to a newcomer or someone who is not super famous. Would that really affect the ratings for the Oscars? Why do we need a huge star to host them? It would be a great opportunity to tout their efforts of inclusion and support new talent. Yes, I totally agree, Chris. It's like, to use a very example that's very right now, it's like when you're casting a superhero like Batman. Batman is the selling point. Like, you could pick an unknown. And they're always trying to fill it with a star. I'm like, it's behind a mask. The character is the selling point. And it's the same thing with the Oscars. We're there for the Oscars. The host is just kind of like a news anchor. They're there to sort of guide you through it, but they're not the show. So yes, we don't need a big, huge star. We don't need a household name. But we do need someone, if you're having a host at all, you need someone who's quick on their feet, and who's funny, and who loves the movies. That's all you need.
Yeah, I agree. Which is why there is an article in the New York Times about the host and what the host means from Kyle Buchanan. And it's a really good article because it sort of lands in, like, basically Whoopi Goldberg was the best Oscar host because she revered the Oscars. It was a dream of hers to win an Oscar, and she was so happy to win. And then, but also she could make fun of them, but while being respectful.
And one
which
of
is
them.
A lot, yeah. Which is a lot of other, like, you get Jimmy Kimmel going, like, oh, to Isabelle Huppert, we never watched Elle. And I'm like, no. People who love the Oscars watched Elle. People who are voting for this have watched Elle. So don't do that. That is disrespectful.
Yeah. Yeah, it just makes you look bad. It doesn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we have a question from David about Ben is Back. Why didn't it get a wide release, and why was Julia Roberts ignored completely from giving one of her best performances ever? And I went to look at this, and yes, it's only been out for 5 weekends.
Which is a lot, though.
That is a lot. But it has only been at the most Christmas week. It was at 162 theaters, and that's the most it's been at. So I don't know. I don't know why. And I do agree that Julia gives a fantastic performance. And I hope she seems to be doing more movies. So maybe she'll do more and she'll continue. And she was in Homecoming too this year. So I'll hope she'll continue working and do more. And maybe the next one will be a bigger hit.
Pardon me for forgetting, but someone in the comments for another article entirely theorized about why Julia Roberts did not get any traction for this, and I apologize that I don't remember who said it, but I thought it was very smart that when you're someone who is, your persona is that you're super popular, like a Julia Roberts or a Sandra Bullock, you get nominated only if your movie is very successful. Julia Roberts movies, her Oscar movies were all big hits. And Sandra Bullock, both of her Oscar movies were blockbusters.
Oh, yes, yes. That's a good way to look at it, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a really... And, you know, Julia was ignored for Closer, which was not a big hit, but people thought she was very good in that. So I think it's the only sort of... The only place that theory falls apart is August Osage County, but that was one of those, like, made-only-to-win Oscar type of movies.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that's why. Why they didn't expand it wide when it has two stars in it, I have no idea. I have no idea. Doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. So we have two questions about Roma and Best Foreign Language and Best Picture. Peggy Sue says, is Roma winning Best Picture and Best Foreign Film, or should we keep an eye on Shoplifters or Capernaum? And then Mirko says, according to you, could Roma actually win Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Foreign Language Film? And I don't know if Roma is, like, the front runner, but it definitely is up there to win Best Picture. And I hope, like, you know, Roma could get nominated for, like, 8 to 10 nominations. So that means, like, they could have 8 chances to give it Oscars. So once you get to that ballot, maybe you choose Shoplifters. That would be my hope. And it would be fun if Shoplifters won, you know, Best Foreign Language, and then, because that would be its only nomination. And then Roma win, I don't know, Cinematography, Director, and maybe Best Picture. You know, everybody's happy that way.
Except for Oscar doesn't work that way. I think Roma's either going to sweep or it's going to have to settle for director, foreign film, and cinematography, which is still a lot, and it's still 3 Oscars for Cuarón himself. Well, I mean, technically, foreign film is not, but anyway, that's a whole nother conversation. But Mexico will get their first foreign film win, so that's something to be excited for.
Yeah.
My preference in the category is Shoplifters, but I think one reason you aren't going to have as big surprises as you used to in that category is that now you're no longer required to watch all five to vote. That used to be one of those categories where you had to prove that you had been to the special screenings in order to vote, but that is no longer the case. So when you have something that is sort of crossing over, it's just, it's not going to be suddenly have the rug swept out from under it like Amelie did, for example, in its year.
Yeah. Or Pan's Labyrinth.
Or
was,
Pan's Labyrinth, yeah.
Yeah. But I think, like, Shoplifters is... And Shoplifters has done almost $2 million, like you mentioned in last week's podcast. So it's doing so well. So people are actually watching it. So it's not Capernaum or one of the other movies that, you know, have been minusculely released. So I think there is a chance because it's been widely seen too. Mm-hmm. And I have actually put this on Twitter and people have responded to me that if it happens, it's going to be Cold War because Cold War is stronger and has buzz in other categories, not just foreign language film.
Yeah, that's possible. But I think the overall quality, assumed, nominations are 2 days away, the overall quality of that foreign film set is actually going to work in Roma's favor.
Because, what do you mean?
Because there's so many great options. It's basically like if they nominate what's expected, any of those would be a great winner. So votes going to be are all over the place, which means Roma takes it.
Yes, because it's the one that's probably more widely seen. Yeah. And yeah, I hear you.
Here's a quick question. Peggy Sue asks, as a member, do you have to vote for 10 movies or can you just vote for 5 or 8 or whatever suits you? From my understanding of the Oscar rules, you do not have to fill in the whole ballot. You can, if you only want to select a few movies, you only select a few movies.
But isn't they also only nominate, they are given 5 spots, they're not given 10, right?
Right. Just in, and there are other, like, I know people aren't asking about Critics' Choice, but this is similar at other places too. Like, the Critics' Choice, even though there's a million nominees, you only get 3 choices on your ballot. And didn't we also have that with Gallica? We only had three choices per ballot.
Yeah, you get 3 in all categories. You get 3 that you rank, and then there's 5 that are nominated in each category.
Yeah. So most, from my understanding, most organizations do it that way, where you don't get to choose everything, because it's all preferential, anyways. Generally speaking, I think that's to limit the numbers they have to calculate. I think. And to assume that anything low on everybody's list doesn't deserve to be there, which is maybe not the case, or also maybe the case, depending on the movie.
Yeah. Well, we got so many good questions.
We really did. Let's do a couple more. BJT asks, do you think voters should have a minimum number of films they should have seen? How would you set the number? And if a CAD member asked you, how would you prioritize seeing the films? This is a great fantasy question. In my ideal world, you couldn't vote unless you'd seen all the nominees. But that's obviously never going to be the case.
Yeah.
But in terms of minimum number you've seen before nominating, that would also be impossible to regulate. But, you know, it is shocking sometimes that they only see like 10 movies and then vote.
Yeah. I mean, and that's reflected in the nominations because it's usually a pool of about 20 movies that all the nominations, almost 100% of the nominations come from a pool of like 15 to 20 movies.
Yeah. Yeah, so we see the limits of how many movies they're actually watching each year in that way. And also the limits of, like, how much imagination people have about their ballots in terms of, like, well, I really liked Bohemian Rhapsody. It's good at everything. When, you know, maybe if you were thinking about it, you would be like, why did I like Bohemian Rhapsody? I'm just being fun. I'm not trying to diss Bohemian Rhapsody. I've dissed it plenty already.
Yeah.
You can think, why do I like it? And the answer, I'm assuming, would probably be Queen. Your feelings about Queen. In which case, how about the sound mixing? That might be a choice that makes sense because you love the way the music's presented. Do you know what I'm saying? But I don't think people really think through their ballots in that way. They just like, oh, I love this movie. That's my feelings about how people choose.
Yeah, that's unfortunately what happens. This is a good question, although I don't think I have a good answer for it. KJ says, favorite scenes or moments in 2018 films, even if the film didn't work as a whole. And the film and the scene that comes to my mind is from The Rider. The Rider is my number one movie of the year. I love it. So this is a movie that totally 100% worked for me. Mm-hmm. But I love this scene where he tames the wild horse. And it's a scene I couldn't shake. And I just remember how beautiful it is. And it's sort of a longer scene. And you get to see that relationship so intimately filmed that I've never seen before between a man and a horse. So that's a standout moment in 2018 films. But it's also in a film that totally worked. So I don't know. Do you have a scene in a movie that didn't work for you that you remember and love?
This is such a hard question. To answer this question, I was looking toward the second. I keep a private list on Letterboxd of everything I see in a year ranked. And the reason I don't make it public is I'm shifting the rank all the time. Yeah. I'll eventually make it public. Once I'm done with the Filmage Awards, so I looked toward the bottom half of and seeing, were there any standout scenes? And one movie that I found disappointing that a lot of people did like was The Miseducation of Cameron Post.
Uh-huh. Yep.
But I thought the ending was really special. So sometimes one scene will have a big impact. And that scene, it's sort of like this three shot of the main characters in the back of a truck, sort of looking out. And it was so open-ended, but it had so much possibility. And maybe it's more like a shot that I responded to, but I think for a movie like that, that was, you know, kind of pedantic in some ways. That had sort of this open spirit of possibility to it that I really responded to. So that was something in a movie that didn't totally work for me that I loved.
Mm-hmm. If we're thinking of climactic scenes, that also reminded me of something. In Mary, Queen of Scots, I loved the last scene, the fictionalized meeting of the queens, when Saoirse Ronan and Margot Robbie are pretty fucking fantastic in that sort of confrontation between Mary and Elizabeth. The movie, that didn't really work for me, but that scene was really good. And it was, you know, they built up to it and it was worth it. Even though I don't think the movie itself worked. So yeah, that one.
Yeah. And I have one other answer to this question. This will be this is a movie I liked, but I didn't love the way so many people did. You Were Never Really Here. That the very unexpected, moment right before there's the whole movie is about people getting killed or whatever. It's a very violent, disconcerting movie, but there's a very quiet moment right after a bunch of violence where you hear the radio playing Charlene, the very famous song, I've Never Been to Me. And that, it was so unexpected and had so much sort of warmth in the middle of this very, very scary, upsetting thing that scene really worked for me. It gave me an angle I wasn't expecting. Sort of relief about someone's humanity, even if it was already gone, at least there was a glimmer still there. Anyway, I thought that scene was really fantastic.
Yeah. Something else that comes to my mind is The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which is a movie that, you know, I appreciated sort of the craft behind it, but I didn't really like it. Mm-hmm. But I did love the story where Tom Waits plays a prospector and it's just him. And that story I thought was sublime. His performance was amazing and the story, just the whole thing from beginning to end, was just beautiful. And it really worked for me. If that was in the shorts, I would say give it best short film of the year. And I also, in that movie, I like the chemistry between Zoe Kazan and Bill Heck in their sort of romantic story. And I thought they played it, you know, they played that that falling in love tentatively very well. But then that story was so obvious that, of course, the Coen brothers are not going to be this romantic. And I knew the minute I saw these very tender romantic scenes, I'm like, oh, something's coming for them. And of course it does.
Yeah, I had the same feeling about Ballad of Buster Scruggs. Like, I wish the Coens, maybe this is asking to be somebody someone they're not, maybe that's not fair, but one of the reasons I brought up that scene and you were never really here is it made me think that Lynn Ramsey, who often makes very unsettling, upsetting mm-hmm. movies in which people are killed or whatever, that is not a reflection of her totality. Like, she has room for all these, like, weird, unexpected, tender angles. And I feel like the Coens, they couldn't give you even one happy thing.
Yeah.
Even if it was happiness in a very sort of gentle, practical, non-fantastical way, which that short film with Zoe Kazan, that felt to me like a very realistic, the way a romance might have played out in those times.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And some of those, I'm sure, ended happily in life.
Yes.
So it kind of exhausts me. The nihilism of the Coen brothers kind of exhausts me sometimes.
Yeah. And I know I don't want to bring up, you know, Nick's most unfavorite movie of the year, At Eternity's Gate, but there is a scene in that movie that works, which is where Van Gogh is shown from beginning to end painting his shoes. Mm-hmm. And the scene is really done well where, you know, he comes in, he takes off his shoes, he puts them on, and then it goes and you see the full painting from beginning to end. And that I thought was a fantastic moment in a totally mediocre movie.
Mm-hmm. That great question. Thank you.
Yes. Do we have more?
We do. We have to talk about Best Actress. It's sort of mandatory at the Film Experience. Mac B asks, if you were an Academy voter, what criteria would you use to make your choices? Specifically with respect to the actress category, do you simply choose your personal favorite performance or the one you consider the most skilled? If not, what other factors do you weigh and what weight do you give overdue narratives, if any? So that's a really great question, and I think the answer is all of the above. I think whenever you're trying to come up with best, which is, you know, very subjective, I think all those things affect people, and people who pretend that those things don't affect them are lying. I just want to say that. They're just not honest with themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I'm aware when I'm doing it, when I'm choosing my ballots, that it's a mix of all those things. What do you think about this, Murtada?
I mean, we all have our biases, and I have to say, I do have my favorites, and mm-hmm. usually whoever I think gives the best performance is usually somebody I really like. So there is that bias for sure. But also, like, for me, it's always about a feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So it's how I felt while watching them and how I'm feeling months later about that performance that sort of makes me choose them as the best of the year. So it is totally subjective, and in most cases it's bias. I acknowledge that, but also that's the way we react to anything, right?
Yeah.
We do not leave ourselves at the door and be completely objective.
Yeah.
So
I would say, because the follow-up part of this question is, if hypothetically, if you thought Gaga was a little bit stronger than Glenn Close, would you vote for Glenn Close to win because she's never won? I'm like, thankfully, I don't have that problem because I think Glenn Close is way better than Gaga in their movies.
Yeah.
But if it were really close for me, and I thought maybe Gaga was slightly better, if I were an Oscar voter, I would still vote for Glenn. I'll just admit it. Mm-hmm. She doesn't have one. She's been great so many times. And if it's, unless it was a huge difference and I thought Gaga was just undeniable the best performance of the year, and then I would vote for that.
Yeah. I think it has to be a performance that is undeniable and also one that you personally like.
Yeah.
For me to, that I press that for me to make the jump. Mm-hmm. But yeah. I don't actually know who I would vote for from the best actress. I guess I'm an Olivia Colman voter because of the likely nominees, she's the only one who made my own personal top five. So that's who I probably would be voting for in best actress.
So a follow-up question on best actress. Charles O asks, could you talk about who will win? I know it sounds a bit weird.
We've talked about this. He says we haven't talked about this, but we have.
Does Colman have a shot? Will Gaga's best song actor block her from winning actress? I don't really think that the best song is going to hurt Gaga. I just think she's not going to win because either Glenn's overdue narrative or Colman being legit their favorite performance this year. Mm-hmm. I think Colman or Close is going to win.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's one of those two. And I mean, let's see what happens after the nominations, but usually like the campaigns will change. And I just think if we get the five we're expecting to win, I don't see any other winner but Glenn Close, because I'm expecting that her overdue narrative will just be kick in and be too big to ignore.
She has tributes coming up, like Palm Springs, all that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, it's Glenn. Let's go. I'm ready.
Andy asks, here's a fun one to end on. We should wrap up. In the last 10 years, is there a film that ranked high on your top 10 list that you no longer love today?
Oh, wow. That needs a little bit of digging. I don't know.
Do you keep top 10 lists, Murtada?
Yes, I do. I don't have top 10 lists for like decades and decades, but I have it for the last few years.
Yeah.
Since I started voting for like, in different critics things. Yeah.
I will say, how dare he ask this question? Because of course my opinions are perfect right to begin with. No, I'm just kidding. Yes, I sometimes look back and go, and the further back you go, the more that happens because time naturally does things to movies and people's careers naturally, their future careers naturally color perceptions of their prior work.
Yep.
Yeah, I don't know. There's, like, I was looking at 2013, and I was kind of, my whole top 10 list, I was kind of like, was the year that bad? Or
what was in your top 10? Now I'm curious.
2013, this was in descending order, so favorite movie first. 12 Years a Slave, Short Term 12, Frances Ha, No, Nebraska, Before Midnight, American Hustle, Blue Jasmine, Spring Breakers, and Enough Said.
Wow.
And I'm like, was 2013 just not a good year? I do love some of those still, but like other ones, like Nebraska, faded a lot for me. Before Midnight, now that I'm away from the flush of the excitement of seeing the completion of, you know, the next installment, it just, you know, it doesn't really hold a candle to the first two movies in that series. So I'm not quite sure why it was all the way up at number 6 on my ballot, you know, so that thing. So there's a little bit of that every year, but 2013 was the year that really stood out for me of like, what was happening that year?
Yeah, I have, like, I'm looking at my list from 2012, and I'm like, what was I thinking? Because there are movies there, like, you know, Amour, and, you know, Beasts of the Southern Wild, and Rust and Bone, that I still love, Middle of Nowhere, still my favorite Ava DuVernay movie. But, like, I had End of Watch. I'm like, what? Why do I have End of Watch in my top 10? That is a crazy choice. It's a movie I have not probably thought of for 1 second since I put it on the list. So, wow.
I have Les Mis in my 2012 top 10. And obviously that has not aged that well. I still love the things I loved about it originally, and I felt people were unfair to it. But I think I got very defensive about that movie, which is why it stayed as high as it did in my top 10 list. But that also happens. If you're human, if you say you love something and everybody starts attacking it, you're like, no, my precious.
Yes, totally. Which is what people in Hollywood are doing with Green Book.
And
which they will kind of look back at it with, they're going to be like, what the fuck were we thinking?
Well, so we didn't get to every question, but there were so many good questions. Really, thank you, everyone. And I think we'll do this again because I had super lots of fun. I hope you did, Murtada.
Yes, this was so much fun. And it made us talk about movies that, you know, we have thought about or talked about in so many years.
Yeah.
So it was fun. And thank you for everyone for your questions and for listening.
And yeah, thanks for listening each week. And we will return to our normal scheduled, very, very Oscar-focused stuff next week when we will have the Oscar nominations themselves to react to.